Okay, yeah, everyone. So we're going to start tonight's Dhamma talk. And I thought today I was going to talk on the topic of devas. And the Pali word deva, in case you don't know this word, it means basically like a divine being. Yeah, sometimes translated as a god. And one of the things that you find when you start reading the word of the Buddha, there's quite a lot there about devas. Yeah, you see devas all over the place. They're coming to have a chat with the Buddha, asking him about the Dhamma, so they can get out of suffering as well. And it's quite a common thing, this the topic of devas in the sutta, as you see it a lot. And there's all kinds of devas, all kinds of heavenly beings of all types. There are some things called like almost like dragons, yeah, in these realms. And then there are all the kind of ordinary devas, like heavenly musicians and powerful gods and less powerful gods and all of these kind of things. And so I thought it might be interesting to discuss what this actually means, whether it is important in Buddhism, whether it's part of the cultural baggage of ancient India, whether it's the baggage that we can throw out and which isn't really necessary to understand the Buddhist teachings, and basically to contemplate what these devas really are, whether they exist or whether they don't exist, or how we should think about them in a constructive way to help us in our practice. So we'll see where that takes us. And one of the interesting things about this word deva is that it is relate to understand what it means. It's actually related to another Pali word which is called deva, and deva means day. The root meaning of this word is like to shine, yeah, to be splendid, to shine. Yes, at the daytime, of course, things shine. Yeah, in the day and night, the dark and day, they shine. So devas, they are like shining beings. That's really kind of the root meaning of what they are all about. They shine in the world. And not only do they shine, but obviously, you know, when you are a god, you tend to have all the things that come with being a divine being, as you can imagine. They are more powerful. Yeah, they have kind of powers that we don't have as humans. They are more happy. They have access to pleasures that we don't have in the human realm, and all of these kind of things. But one of the most interesting aspects of them is that they shine. Yeah, they're kind of beautiful beings. They kind of have a splendor about them. They radiate something which we don't see, obviously, in the human realm. So you can imagine this radiant being. Yeah, this radiant being is what the devas really are like. And this external quality of being radiant, of course, it simply reflects the inner qualities of those beings. The way that you become a deva, the way that you get reborn in that particular realm, is by living well in this life. Yeah, it's by having all the good qualities of heart, being kind, being compassionate, being generous, being caring, all of these good qualities, having a degree of wisdom as well. All of these are parts and parcel of how to get reborn in these realms. So they have all of these good qualities. And those good qualities are reflected in how they look externally. Yeah, it's like they are radiant through those good qualities that they have with them in their heart. So it's kind of, when you think of it like that, it's kind of beautiful. Yeah, it's kind of powerful in a sense. And you can see this to some extent also in the human realm. Sometimes you see people who are very kind of radiant in a certain way, yeah, it depends a little bit, but they have a certain quality about them, and the quality of purity of heart, of kindness, and all of these kind of things. You can see that also in the human realm, but certainly you can see it in the Devaloka. So it's kind of attractive. Imagine seeing a being like that, yeah, seeing somebody really translucent, powerful, radiant, yeah, like a small sun. Yeah, this is kind of the devas. They're like small suns, yeah, radiating in the world. So would it be cool to see something like that? It would be cool, right? And I'll talk a little bit more about that later on, because people see these kind of beings. I know Ajahn Brahm gave a talk here a few years ago, and he has this theory that, you know, we have this idea of UFOs. I think now they have a new name now. They're called AVU, no, what are they called? Anyway, UAVs, something like that. I think that's the new name for UFOs, to make them more neutral or something like that. And Ajahn Brahm has this idea that UFOs actually what they are. They are devas. Yeah, devas in the human realm. And that's kind of a neat idea. It's a really neat idea because, first of all, we don't really know what these UFOs are, or UAVs, whatever they're called. We don't know what they are. But the second thing, which is kind of a bit of a conundrum, is that at the time of the Buddha, sometimes they would see these devas. How come we don't see them now? Well, maybe we do see them. We just have a different name for them. We call them UFOs instead. So UFOs and devas, basically the maybe the same thing. It's not the words are not connected with each other, but maybe it's the same thing. It's kind of an interesting idea. Maybe these things actually are out there, even though we can't see them. So these are devas, and another kind of interesting little fun fact about devas is that there's a very close connection between the ancient Vedic deities. The Vedas were ancient Vedic deities. Vedism is the religion that existed in India before Buddhism, and it was full of all kinds of deities. And some of those deities were then inherited by the rest of the world because the Indian influence on the rest of the world was very significant. So it spread out. And in Europe, there is a deva called, I'm not sure exactly what the name of this deva was, Tuesday or something like that, and that became the name for Tuesday. So Tuesday is actually Deva Day. It's the same word related to the Pali word Deva. Kind of interesting. And of course, the rest of the days of the week, we know that they are all named after gods. You have Wednesday is named after Odin. My favorite god, Odin. I was born in Norway, so Odin, yay, Odin is the best. And then we have Thor, another kind of one of my favorite gods who kind of creates all the thunder. So when you hear the thunder, remember that that's Thor, Someone told me a while ago that his mum told him that's Thor, kind of when he or she heard the thunder in the sky. And then Freya, of course. So there's actually 4 days of the week named after gods, but one of them is named after Deva. So it says Deva Day is Tuesday. Interesting, right? So how important are these devas? Are they cultural baggage? Do they matter? Now, to approach this question, I'm going to tell you a couple of stories from the suttas. The suttas are the word of the Buddha. So these are not just the word of the Buddha. Some of them are also stories told by later generations, like narratives. They talk about what the Buddha is doing, how he behaves, the kind of things that he gets up to. And the Buddha is a bit like seeing a Marvel movie. When you see Buddha, he does things like they do in the Marvel movies. He kind of flies through the air, he sorts things out. Sometimes he does that, but is that really important? That's one of the things I want to talk about first of all. And this first story is a bit of like a Marvel story. It's a bit marvelous. And this is a story of the Buddha soon after his awakening. Soon after the Buddha's awakening, he then decides to teach what is known as the group of five disciples, Panchavagya Bhikkhu, a group of five disciples. And these were the people, the five disciples, who look after the Buddha while he was still a bodhisattva, while he was still searching for awakening. Awakening is my term for kind of enlightenment. I prefer the word awakening because to me it's more meaningful. So then he goes to teach his five disciples, and after he taught the five disciples, a few more people come in and they get taught as well, and they all become awakened. They all reach awakening because they were all very ready for awakening. They were the first disciples of the Buddha. The best people came first, and the slightly more slow characters came later on. Until our generation, we are the really slow ones. 2,500 years, we still haven't got it. But there's still hope. That's why we're still here. I'm just being a bit silly. Don't take that too seriously. So he teaches all of these people, and he says to all of these awakened disciples, he says, not two of you should go the same way. You should go to all directions and spread the message of awakening to the world. The message of awakening means the message of overcoming suffering, of achieving the highest happiness. That's really what it is about. That's what awakening really is about. So it's extremely worthwhile if we can achieve that. So they all go in different directions, and the Buddha goes in his own direction. And then this is the narrative. This is why I'm saying this is a story. Yeah? It's not really a sutta by the Buddha. It's more like a story. And it goes to this various place, and all of these various places, all of these kind of events happen. Yeah, and it teaches the Dhamma, and all these things happen as it does that. It's quite an interesting story here. If you're interested in this, you can read it online, yeah, in my translation. I'm not joking, it is actually my translation. So I'm a bit proud of this. I thought I might as well mention that here in public. Let's just make it clear everyone knows about it. If you go to a website called suttacentral.net, it is one of the most best websites for the suttas, the word of the Buddha, anywhere in the world. Yeah, it's probably the most up-to-date one with translations into all kind of languages, into Norwegian even, or in English, and whatever is your favorite language, you can find it there. Yeah, whether it's in Chinese characters, or you can read it in Vietnamese, or you can read it in Greek maybe, if you want to read it in Greek, if you can read Greek, or whatever language that you prefer, you can pretty much find it there. And if you go to the Vinaya Pitaka, the part of the Buddhist canon, which is about the monks' rules and regulations, the first chapter, or what is called the chapter section, it is right there. You can read all the stories of the Buddha, what the Buddha was up to straight after his awakening. Remember, these are stories, yeah? Not necessarily to be taken literally. Yeah. So one of these stories, the Buddha goes to these fire ascetics. They're called Jatilas in ancient Pali, fire ascetics. So what do fire ascetics do? They worship the fire. Yeah, so they have this fire that burns, and they worship that fire. And this still happens in India in the present day. If you travel to India and you go to some of those famous ashrams in India, you will find that there are Brahmins or spiritual ascetics who actually worship the fire. And of course, the reason why they worship the fire is that the fire is incredibly powerful. You know, in the world which is very simple, where you have really material well-being is very based on very simple requisites, fire is a very powerful implement. With fire, you can forge the iron into tools. Yeah, you can use it to cook things and sterilize things through cooking. You can use it for burning down the forest if you need more agricultural land. It's a very powerful tool. So you can see why they would worship something so powerful, and they would always keep it burning. Yeah. So these three fire ascetics, they were called the Kassapa brothers. We have a monk called Kassapa at our monastery. He is not one of those fire ascetics, so you can be safe. He's not going to burn you or anything like that. He's actually a very nice monk. He's a bit like a bear, teddy bear. Is that right, Osaga? He's like a Kassapa. He's a bit like a kind of round and cozy monk, yeah. He's a bit like a teddy bear. He's kind of round and kind of and very, very friendly monk, actually. Yeah. So he's not one. I don't think he took his name after those fire ascetics. I think he took his name after the monk called Maha Kassapa, which is another Kassapa. Kassapa was quite a famous name in ancient India. I don't know if people are still called Kassapa in India. Is there still Kassapas in India? Anyone from India here? Are there many Kassapas in India these days? Maybe, maybe not. Not sure. We have to research more on that one. Well, next time I come here, we're not sure what that's going to be, I'll tell you more about the Kassapa. So they're all called Kassapa, these three brothers. And the Buddha goes to them and he speaks to them. He sees that these are people who are ripe for understanding the Buddhist teachings, because the fire ascetics, they already had an understanding of the world that was similar to the Buddhist understanding. They had ideas about karma and rebirth, understanding the danger in existence, yeah, that was similar to the Buddhist ideas. So he knew that they were likely to understand his teachings. So he goes to this Kassapa brother and he says to them, "Do you mind if I stay in your fire hut?" Fire hut is where they keep the sacred fire, yeah? "Can I stay in your fire hut?" Aggi sala or aggi gara. Anyway, something like that. And Aggi is the Agni or Aggi is the ancient Indian word for fire. And this is also a word for God. Yeah, it's a particular god called Agni because they worship the fire. So he goes, "Can I stay in your fire hut? This is the holy place." Yeah, and of course, the Buddha was already a holy person and they would have recognized him as such. can I stay in your forest? And they say to him, well, you can. There's only one problem. There is a dragon in that fire hut. And if you go into that fire hut and stay there, the dragon would surely kill you. Yeah, you haven't got a chance. It's a very, very powerful dragon. And these dragons don't like people just coming into the hut like that. You're in trouble, so better to go somewhere else. The Buddha says again, can I stay in your fire hut? The Kassapa brother says the same thing. And for a third time, the Buddha says, may I stay in your fire hut? Never mind, don't worry about me. Yeah, I'll be all right. You don't know me, so just I'll be fine, says the Buddha. So can I stay in your fire hut? And so eventually they give up. If you say things three times in Buddhism, it means that you're really serious. Yeah, okay, so then the other person really has to have a really good reason to decline. So he says, okay, you can stay in my fire hut. So now it is set for this battle, yeah, between the dragon on the one hand and the fire hut, and then the Buddha on the other hand. The stage is set for something very exciting to happen. The Buddha goes into this fire hut. He sits down, and when the Buddha sits down, he always sits down with kind of his crossed leg to do some meditation and things. And then as he does so, the dragon, yeah, are you sure you don't want to hear about the dragon? I see you're leaving there. Is this this may be a bad time to leave, you know? The dragon story is coming here. Okay. So the dragon goes into the fire, and the dragon is not pleased. Yeah, dragons are not pleased when you go into your fire hut. I don't know if you had an experience with that, but that's how it is. So he goes into the fire hut, and the dragon emits smoke. Yeah, and then when the dragon, he too emits smoke. And the dragon gets even more displeased because he sees this fire ascetic or this monk emitting smoke. And he emits fire, flames coming out of this dragon. Yeah, and then the Buddha also emits flames. And then they carry on like this all night, emitting smoke, emitting flames, yeah? And the Kassapa brothers, they kind of come around this hut, and they look at this hut, they see this whole hut is ablaze with all these flames and fires and everything, yeah? And then towards the morning, everything goes dark, yeah? And then in the morning, the Buddha comes out of the kuti, yeah? Out of this little fire hut, and then he has a bowl in his hand, and then he says to the Kassapa brothers, well, here is that dragon of yours in the bowl, and he hands that dragon to them, yeah, in the little bowl. In this way, the Buddha overcame fire with fire, smoke with smoke, and he subdued this dragon in this little, fire hut. Yeah, so he brought this dragon, there wasn't much left of the dragon, it was completely exhausted, sitting in a little bowl, and he gave it to the Kassapa brothers. So that is one of those little stories in the suttas. What does this mean? Does this mean that you are a bad Buddhist if you don't believe in these kind of things? Probably half of you would leave then, right? You probably would go straight away if you have to believe in this to be a Buddhist. What do we do with these kind of things? How significant is it? And this is just one small part of a long story with all of these kind of things. Yeah, and it's kind of hard to know what to make of it. And I thought for a while I was going to take a kind of hands up and see how many of you believe in this and how many people say this is good stuff and how many of you don't believe in it. And if you don't believe in this, I sympathize with you. If you do believe in it, I also sympathize with you. This is how you get many disciples, you see, everyone. And this is how you get many friends. Yeah, you kind of side with everyone. And if you are uncertain, I also side with you. And the point is that, you know, the reason why I sympathize with you if you believe in this or you think this may be possible or whatever is that the Buddha was a very powerful person. And it's very hard to really know the limits of the powers of a being like the Buddha. And because it is that, it's actually not advisable to kind of just reject it out of hand. Yeah, and you've been a Buddhist a long time. Maybe such things are true. Maybe it's possible. If you don't believe in it, I also kind of sympathize with you because this just seems over the top. Yeah, why does the Buddha indulge in these kind of things anyway? Isn't he supposed to be here to make us wiser, to overcome suffering? What's the point of these battles of fire and flames? Surely this is just an embellishment of this ancient literature. And there is probably a lot of truth to that. Yeah, one of the things that we use to decide what is authentic Buddhism is to look at these stories. These stories often come in many different versions. Yeah, sometimes in all of these ancient versions, you have the version in the Pali language, which is what I'm relying on now. You have versions that are translated into Chinese. You have versions that exist in Sanskrit language, some of them in Tibetan language, some of them in really obscure language, don't exist anymore. Yeah, really obscure that language that existed in Central Asia 2,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago. And so what we do when we see stories like this is that we collect all the ancient material together. These are material existing in different schools, and we look to see if it matches. Are these stories found in all the various schools? And one of the very interesting results of doing that kind of study is that a lot of the stories that have to do with supernormal powers are not really reliable. Yeah, you realize actually these things are stories, they are narratives that were probably added after the Buddha passed away, but they're not reliable reflections of what actually happened in ancient India. It is very uncertain. The Buddha probably did not tame dragons. Yeah, he probably didn't do kind of this kind of fire thing in this way. It probably wasn't actually happening. Could he do it? Maybe he could, but he didn't do it. And that is kind of the point here. And why didn't the Buddha do it? And the answer is found in one of those famous suttas called the Kevada Sutta in the long discourse of the Buddha, where the Buddha says, I abhor, I detest, I'm revolted by these supernormal powers. That's what he literally says. He doesn't say they don't exist. He says, I'm revolted by them. And the reason he says that is because he says that if I or the monks or the nuns or anyone really for that matter were to display these supernormal powers, and the context here is that one of the people, lay people, have come to him and said, oh, please, master, please, please display more supernormal power, because if you do so, people will gain more faith in you. But the Buddha says, no, that is not true. Because those people who already have faith and confidence in the Buddha's awakening, they will say, marvelous, wonderful, you can fly through the air and walk on water. Wow, that's really cool. And those people who don't have faith, they will say, ah, it's just a magic trick. It's just the ancient David Copperfield or whatever it is doing his tricks. Yeah. And that's what they will say. You're just using some kind of magic medallion to be able to make these things work out. And of course, that is some truth to that, yeah? When we see magic around the world, it's usually a trick of deception that deceive you right there in front of your eyes. I remember seeing this amazing thing. You can see it on YouTube if you like. There's a British magician called Dynamo. You can Google this and you can see the YouTube video. I've seen it. This is what monks get up to when we go to YouTube, is we watch this kind of stuff. Don't tell anyone, it's a secret business. And what he does, he's kind of standing on the bank of the River Thames, yeah, in the central London, on the River Thames, the Waterloo Bridge is right there. And he's kind of standing there as if he's about to walk onto the water, yeah? And people are kind of accumulating on the bridge, and people are pointing, look, what's going on? There's a modern Jesus down there. He's about to walk on the water. Yeah? And slowly, he gets down, yeah, with all these people watching, and he actually walks out on the water. Yeah? It's an amazing sight when you see it. And that's what he does, yeah? And when you see it, you think, you know, what is he doing, walking on water? This is, you know, what's going on here? And of course, it's just a very simple trick, yeah? Once you know the trick, it's really, really simple. But that's what he does. And of course, this is what people do throughout the world. They trick you into seeing things that actually aren't really going on. So this is the second thing that we should remember. A lot of the time when we see the Buddha in the sutta sometimes doing these supernormal things, don't take it too seriously. This is not what the Dhamma is about. This is a sidetrack. It's actually irrelevant. Maybe the Buddha could do it. I certainly think the Buddha could do some extraordinary things, and I would have little doubt that he could do these kind of things as well, but it's not Dhamma. It is what faithful people wrote into the suttas in later generations to make the Buddha appear special. Yeah, and it's not really a reliable source for what Buddhism really is about. So that's why I said I sympathize with both sides, yeah? Because both sides, in a sense, are correct in this. And I certainly sympathize with those of you who say, I don't know, because how can we know these things? And I have to say that if you say, I don't know, congratulations for at least having an open mind. That is one of the most important things sometimes on the spiritual path, is to have an open mind, because there are some remarkable things that are possible on the spiritual path. At the very least, then you are open to the idea of meditation being able to give very good results. So this is one of these stories, yeah, of the Buddha that you find in the suttas. Another story I will tell you, this gives a slightly different angle on this idea of special beings and supernormal powers and all of that, these kind of things. The one I talked about just now was a dragon. A dragon is called a naga in Pali. It's like half serpent, half dragon. It's a kind of deity, if you like. But this other story is about a much more powerful deity. And this is a deity called Sakka, that you may have heard of. Sakka, one of the most important deities in the Buddhist scriptures. Sakka was known as the Devinda. Inda means Lord, yeah, and Deva is the gods. He was the Lord of the gods. He was the ruler of the gods. And Sakka, he wanted to see the Buddha. Yeah, he had some questions to ask the Buddha. Sakka was very wise, it turns out. Even though he was the Lord of the gods, he was a very wise person. And so he wants to see the Buddha because he had some past connection with the Buddha. I can't remember the exact details now. There was some past connection. But he's a bit shy. Yeah. That's kind of sweet, isn't it? The Lord of the gods is shy. It's like Trump being shy or something like that. Hard to imagine, isn't it? So the Lord of the gods is shy. And so he says to his heavenly musician, they're called Gandhabas, heavenly musician, says, you go down and get the attention of the Buddha, and then once you have his attention and you have kind of asked the Buddha, can I approach, then I will come down and I will approach the Buddha too. So he sends down this heavenly musician called Panchasika. Panchasika goes down to the Buddha. The Buddha is staying in a cave known as the Inda Sala cave. Inda is the same as the Lord. Sala is like a hall, yeah? So the hall of the Lord cave. He's staying there, and then the Panchasika comes with his instrument. He has a lute, which a lute is like a string instrument, I think. So he plays this string instrument, yeah, like a sitar or something like that. And he sings this song, yeah, to get the attention of the Buddha. What kind of song do you think he would sing to get the attention of the Buddha? What is an appropriate song to get the attention of the Buddha? I wonder. You know, maybe a song about the Triple Gem, or the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Maybe you shouldn't sing about those things, though. It's a bit strange, yeah? Maybe a song about the Noble Eightfold Path. It's a bit dry, isn't it? A song about the Noble Eightfold Path. So what he sings to the Buddha is a love song, yeah? Kind of amazing, isn't it, when you think about it? But this is actually the story. The story is that he goes down to the Buddha, and to get the Buddha's attention, he sings a love song. And this love song is not love to the Buddha. It's about this girl that he was in love with. Yeah, and he talks about this girl. And then he says things in the love song, like, just like the arahants. Yeah, the arahants, the enlightened ones, just like the enlightened ones love the Dhamma, love the teaching of the Buddha, in the same way I love this girl. Kind of extraordinary, right? I mean, what is kind of two separate worlds, and he kind of merges these separate worlds in this way. It's kind of remarkable when you think about it. How is this possible? It sounds really weird. Anyway, I'll come back to this in a second, why this might have happened. And so then, you know, the Buddha gets the Buddha's attention. What do you think the Buddha says when he hears this song? He says, oh yeah, this is actually what he says according to the story. He says, oh yeah, your voice and your instrument are nicely in tune. That's what he says, yeah. He doesn't say the love song is great. He doesn't say love songs are recommended. He defines a nice way of saying something positive, yeah, about what's going on. Your voice and your lute are nicely attuned with each other. And then this Panchasika, he says, oh, Sakka, by the way, Sakka, the Lord of the gods, wants to see you. Huh? And the Buddha says, oh, please, may Sakka come. And then Sakka comes, yeah, with this large entourage of devas, lots of devas coming down. And they light up the whole cave where the Buddha is staying, the Indasala cave gets lit up by all these devas because they are shining beings. Yeah, And then they start to ask him questions. They ask the Buddha questions. And the questions they ask the Buddha are really good questions. This is why I love this particular sutta. They're really profound questions about one of the first questions they ask. Actually, I should maybe mention this because this is, instead of just telling stories, I should tell some real Dhamma as well. And one of the first questions that he asks is, why is it when the whole world wants to live in peace, we want to live in harmony, we don't want to have enmity, we don't want to fight, we don't want to have violence. Why is it when we want to live in peace and harmony together in the whole world, everyone wants that. Nobody wants violence and all of this aggression and all of these terrible things that are happening in the world. Why is it when everyone wants that, we still are violent, we're still angry, we're still aggressive, we still have wars, we still have violence in the world? It's a really good question, right? And this is kind of one of the tragedies of the world, in a sense. Yeah, is the fact that we all want to get along together. We want to live in peace together. This is so important for our sense of well-being, that we have harmony. If you come here to the Buddha Society and you are in an argument with somebody, can you really meditate? No, you can't, because your mind is racing. You're thinking about all the counter arguments you're going to make to this person, that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's terrible. The Buddha says harmony is one of the requirements for the spiritual path to work. Yeah, it is so important. So he asks this really profound and beautiful questions. Why is it that we cannot do that, even though we understand how important it is? And the Buddha then goes through a sequence of things. First of all, the Buddha said, well, it's because of, now I'm really out of my depth because I haven't looked at this for a long time. It just sort of dawned on me I should say something about this. But the Buddha said something like, it's because of desire, yeah, that the world does not live in harmony in this way. Yeah. And then the Lord of the Gods says, well, why do people have desire? And he goes, question and answer like this, back and back and back, looking at this as a causal sequence. Yeah, why is it that these things happen? Everything in Buddhism is causality. Yeah? And then it comes down to the root cause. And the root cause is because human beings, not only human beings, gods, yeah? The Sakya says, why is it that gods also have violence and problems? That's an interesting point, yeah? Even in the heavenly realm, still have violence and these kind of problems. And the Buddha says the root cause is this thing called papancha. Papancha means this proliferation of the mind, where we are, and a proliferation of the mind has to do with three things. It has to do with our sense of self, yeah, our ego. We want to protect our ego, our sense of self, who we are. If other people attack us, or they somehow we feel threatened by others, then that is often where aggression happens. Yeah, we see this around the world. This is my nationality, you know, stay out of my country. Yeah, and this is one of the things, reason why we go to war, or don't threaten my family. This is my family, stay away. Or this is me, don't say bad things about me. I want to hear good things about me. And the other one is craving, yeah, and views. These are the things that we fight over in the world. And these are the things that we try to eliminate on the spiritual path of Buddhism. Craving, views, and the conceit, I am, the sense of self. These are the root problems that drive all the violence and all the problems in the world. It's a nice topic for a talk, but not today. Too much, getting too far away. So, yeah, so this is the meeting of Sakya with the Buddha. And this gives you a very different angle on the meeting between gods, the idea of gods. Yeah, it's a very different angle on this whole idea. It's a very different viewpoint from the previous. The previous one was kind of really wild and out there. It's like seeing some kind of movie. Yeah, but this one here is more like, it has much more realistic. Yeah. So maybe this did happen. In fact, there are suttas where, in various traditions, as I mentioned before, precisely where Sakya does come down to the Buddha in this way, yeah, in the various schools of Buddhism, etc. So this seems more likely. And here we are dealing with something that is much more Buddhist. Yeah, this sounds much more realistic. Yeah. But first of all, why does Panchasika come down with the his sitar or his lute and play a love song to the Buddha? Why does that happen? It sounds so out there. Yeah, why this? It's the only place in the suttas you find a love song. It's the only love song in the suttas. And I just think that that's what people do. Yeah, people don't know any better. Yeah. People are not really Buddhist already. And I shouldn't say people, I should say devas, it's all the same. They're not Buddhist, they don't really know what is appropriate. They think, yeah, I got this nice love song, I'll whack a few arahants and a few Buddhas and a bit of enlightenment in there, mix it all up, and I'll sing that. Sounds good, yeah? So this is how people think, yeah? So you get this love song, and I think that's actually how things probably work. And to me, that is almost a sign of authenticity, because no one would dare to put anything like that in there unless it was real. So maybe it is a sign of authenticity. I don't know. Maybe it is a kind of interesting idea. But we're starting to see here, anyway, regardless of that particular episode, we're starting to see that there is something here with the devas that is much more Buddhist. Yeah, and it says in the suttas elsewhere, it says that the Buddha was the teacher of gods and humans. Yeah, the Buddha was the one with the greatest wisdom. It didn't matter if you were a god or not. A god doesn't necessarily mean you are wise. If you're a god, just means you have been a good person. You have a good heart. You've been reborn in a higher realm. You have some wisdom, because goodness requires some degree of wisdom, but you don't have that profound wisdom which the Buddha has, which transcends kinds of our ordinary experience. So this is where we're starting to get this idea that, you know, gods, they have actually a place in Buddhism. Yeah, they are beings just like us. They are really no different. And one of the reasons why the Buddha talks about them is for us to understand the world fully. Yeah, for the Buddha to be able to really explain the world to us, so we can transcend the world. First of all, you have to understand that world. And if there are beings in other realms, yeah, in other areas where you can get reborn if you behave in a certain way, some bad realms, some good realms, you need to know about it to have a full understanding of the problem we are in, and also an understanding of why the spiritual path matters. So actually, it has a very important place in the Buddha's teachings. Yeah, it matters. The Buddha was teacher of gods and humans, according to the most standard verse that we often chant in Buddhism. You see throughout the suttas, the Ittipiso verse, Ittipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho, a very standard verse in the suttas, Satta Deva Manusanang, which means teacher of gods and humans, is right there. So it is an important part of Buddhism. So the question then is, if it is an important part of Buddhism, how does this idea of gods stack up? Yeah, how can we make sense of it? How does it stack up with kind of our modern understanding of God? Our modern understanding of God is often the kind of Christian understanding, or maybe an Islamic understanding of one God. But here we're talking about many gods. And I think it can be quite useful to look a little bit very briefly at kind of modern anthropology. Anthropology, yeah, the study of human beings and how we think and how we live in our societies, a bit like sociology. I don't really know exactly the distinction between these things, but something like that. And according to modern ideas of gods and the evolution of gods over, you know, millennia and centuries, the idea is that, well, early on, the reason why people had gods was because they needed something to explain nature. Yeah, but lightning, bang, whoa, that's really scary. Where does it come from? Must have been a god, must have been Thor. Thor was throwing his hammer. That's when I used to believe before I became a Buddhist. Actually, not really. I should have believed in that, because now I realize maybe it's not so wrong after all. Maybe there's some smidgen of truth, maybe not the full truth, but a smidgen of truth to that. So we needed something to explain the powers of the world, volcanoes, earthquakes, maybe the powerful rains that cause floods, and how can we get enough crops so we can feed our family and our clan? Well, we need to propitiate, we need to kind of pray to the gods and give them an offering so that they will give us something back. And then you have the gods of fertility, which also give you children. Yeah, you need to have lots of children so you can have a big army, you can fight the neighboring village, all of these kind of things. Yeah, that's how it often works. This is the kind of the original idea of where gods come from. And I think there's some truth to that. Yeah, it kind of makes sense. And of course, once you have a god, that is responsible for that, it means that you have some way of dealing with the problem. Yeah, because the gods are beings, they can be spoken to. Yeah, okay, God, what, you know, how can I make you not make earthquakes? How can I make you give a good crop so we can feed all the people? Okay, you need to offer 100 sheep, yeah, kill 100 sheep, I will take those 100 sheep, then I will give you a good crop, yeah? Or sometimes they did human sacrifice. Lots of really crazy things were done in the name of propitiating the gods. So the gods would be happy, and the gods would kind of, you know, in turn, give something back to the human beings. And this is a part of human history, part of anthropological theory, but it kind of makes sense. And then, of course, as time went on, they realized that, well, maybe it's too complex with all these gods. We need to simplify things a bit. Let's just pray to the head god, yeah? And after a while, the head god became more and more powerful. The other gods, they kind of vanished on the sidelines. And then we ended up with a Christian kind of god, yeah? Or an Islamic kind of god, yeah? One god who created the universe, who created each one of us, who created the world, who is all-powerful, everlasting, all-loving, basically everything, yeah? This is kind of the idea of the Christian god. And then, of course, we took it one step further. We said, yeah, why do we even believe in this? Do we need this one God? Nah, we don't need even the one God. Let's become atheists instead. Yeah, we're all atheists. That's kind of even one step beyond. So the anthropologists, they have this idea of human evolution, where one more primitive stage takes over for a more advanced stage, an even more advanced stage. The primitive stage is supposed to be the polytheistic stage. We have many gods. Then you have the one God, yeah? And then you have no gods at all. You chuck out even the last God. Actually, that fits a bit with Buddhism. We don't have that one God either, maybe. Anyway, so you become an atheist, yeah? And this is considered like almost like a hierarchy of sophistication in the modern world, yeah? You get more and more sophisticated. You throw things out. But the interesting question is, it doesn't fit very well with the Buddhist idea of gods. So could this whole idea of sophistication actually turn out to be wrong? Could it be that this is somehow wrong? I think there is some truth to this idea. We want to explain the powers of the world. We need some way to explain that, you know, through making up these gods or whatever. But I don't think it is the full truth. I think there is another very interesting fact here. And that other interesting fact is that if you look at human history, if you look at all the various human societies around the world, almost all of them have been polytheistic. They've all had large numbers of gods. Yeah, if you go to China, for example, go to Chinese society, Chinese society is full of gods. Yeah, and they've always had lots of gods. Go to India, well, I've just been talking about India. We know India had heaps of gods. You go to Europe, gods everywhere. Yeah, you go to Greece, the Romans, the Nordics, my ancestors. I don't know if they're my ancestors, but whatever. They all believed in gods. Yeah, Zeus and Jupiter and Odin or whatever. If you go to societies in Africa, all polytheistic. If you go to the American Indian societies, they were polytheistic. This seems to be like almost all societies in the world were polytheistic. They believed in all of these gods out there. Why is that the case? And I say very often when something is found in so many different societies, it means that all of those societies are tapping into an underlying reality. Yeah, this is one way of explaining it anyway. Tapping into the same underlying reality, and that is why we can so different societies so far apart didn't really have any communication. We're talking about the ancient Egyptians, the Mesopotamian society that, you know, existed 8,000 years ago or whatever. Yeah, they were like this everywhere. So I say one of the maybe likely even reasons for that is that we are tapping into an underlying reality. Sometimes we have visions of these gods. Sometimes we have interactions with them. Yeah, something is going on there which makes us believe and accept these things. To me, that is a very natural explanation. Just like so many things that we have in common across cultures, across the entire globe, why does all human beings, why do all of us have these things in common? Because we have some kind of commonality that we are referring to, and that is what makes it possible. And this is not just the case for the idea of many gods, it's also the case for ideas such as rebirth. Yeah, there's a very interesting study done by a Sri Lankan anthropologist called Gananath Obayasekara, who later on taught at Princeton University in the United States. And he pointed out that the ideas of rebirth exist again in many, many, many societies around the world. Why is that? That such different societies have this idea. Again, I think it may be because we're tapping in to an underlying reality that actually is there. Another interesting study was by somebody doing near-death experiences. And he said near-death experiences are also universal in all human cultures, as far back as you can go. You read ancient literature, you find descriptions of near-death experience, or what appears to be near-death experiences. Again, very interesting. Again, yeah, it seems like we're tapping into an underlying reality. He was actually making the thesis that all religions go back to this idea of near-death experiences, yeah? Because religions tend to be similar in certain ways, and he proposed that these near-death experiences are the cause for religion. I don't know if it's as simple as that, but that was his idea. So I say, and I think, that one likely experience why we have many gods in Buddhism, why there are many gods throughout human society, is that an underlying reality that we're all tapping into, yeah, that is also part of the explanation. And that is kind of fascinating, yeah, once you start to look at it that way, because then it starts to feel maybe there's some reality to this. Yeah, if all of these various societies see this, maybe there's some kind of reality to these gods. One of the strange conundrums in the Buddhist suttas that I always thought was kind of weird, I couldn't really explain. In the Buddhist suttas, in the suttas with devas and gods, very often you find the names of the ancient Vedic gods. The Vedic gods are the gods that existed in India prior to Buddhism. And so why are these found in the suttas? Yeah, I was always weird. I thought, is this some kind of pollution? The suttas have been polluted by the previous civilizations in India. You know, how can we wash off the pollution from the suttas? It's kind of that was my first instinct. Yeah, this shouldn't really be there. What is the point of these kind of ancient Vedic gods in the suttas? But then I realized that actually that's maybe the wrong way to look at it. Because really, these are just names of gods. What do the names matter? If the underlying reality is the same, then Buddhists have the same underlying reality as the ancient Indians before the Buddhists had, yeah? But the names are kind of random. Okay, in the Nordic countries, they're called Odin and Thor. In Greece, they're called Zeus. Rome, they're called Jupiter and Saturn. In India, they're called Sakka and Indra or whatever. But the names are kind of irrelevant. They're just labels we place on them. But the under gods are still the same. Same thing here. So I thought, it's just the Buddhists taking on board these names. The names are actually irrelevant. That's how I could make peace with that. I didn't have to clean out those suttas anymore and wash them out and get rid of all the dross and the accumulated impurities from other civilizations. I thought, okay, I can relax now. So that was kind of useful insight, in a sense, when that happened. But there was another thing which is very interesting about all of this, which occurred to me a while back, and that is the fact that, well, these gods that we're talking about now, they are very human in many ways, yeah. They are very limited. They have a certain lifespan. They live for a certain time. They have happiness and suffering in their life, maybe less suffering than we have and more happiness, but still, similar kind of things, yeah. You can actually converse with them, yeah. You can meet them, you can have conversations, yeah, because they are real beings. And so these are actually beings that you can, at least in theory, and I know people who have seen such beings, yeah, and you can, at least in theory, talk to them. And that is why I'm talking about tapping into the same underlying reality, because all of these various civilizations and societies may actually have had that contact with those beings. But when it comes to the idea of a creator god, yeah, it is impossible to have an experience that is that corresponds to the idea of creation of the world. There's no such experience to be had. There's no experience that corresponds to the idea of existing eternally, like some of these creator gods are supposed to be. Such an experience is impossible. You cannot have an experience of eternity. You can see a fragment. You can have a very deep state of meditation where everything seems very solid, seems very selfless, seems very powerful. But you cannot actually experience eternity. That is an interpretation. The idea of a creator God, also you cannot actually experience the creation of yourself through a creator God. That too is an interpretation. So to me, the idea of all these gods that Buddhism talk about are far more real than the idea of a creator God. A creator God is a made-up idea, made up by human beings, because it can never be experienced in reality. It is a creation of human culture coming through the millennia and centuries, but the experience cannot actually be had. So it is really speculation. It is metaphysics. Yeah, it is an idea that goes beyond what can possibly be experienced in this world. So I would say, yeah, that, and this kind of turns conventional wisdom on its head. Before I said that for the anthropologist, you start off with the polytheistic religions, you end up with a monotheistic religion, and that is considered more sophisticated. I say it's really the other way around. The polytheistic religion is in some way more sophisticated because it actually can, at least in principle, relate to real experience. Whereas the monotheistic religion is really only a philosophical statement. It's a speculation, it's an interpretation of certain ideas in the world. And for that reason, it can never really be based on experience in quite the same way. So for me, polytheism is more real than the idea of monotheism. So, and that's my opinion about this, and I hope you don't feel completely, you know, feel this is a terrible thing to say. Maybe for some of you, sometimes we get people who are Christian who come here, and I apologize. I don't really mean to offend you. I'm just telling you this is how I see it. And that kind of turns conventional wisdom and the world a bit upside down when you see it in that way. What is really real? Yeah, and what is an imaginary construct that we have built up through our society and culture. But I want to summarize a little bit. These were some of the main points I wanted to make, because I think it's fascinating. Sometimes we throw out ideas like these gods in Buddhism, when actually they are fairly far more solid, in my opinion, than the ideas of a creator God in the universe. So what can we learn from all of this? And the first thing to learn is that the idea of gods in Buddhism actually is important. It matters. Yeah, these things are not insignificant. It has to do with the structure of the universe, with the Buddhist cosmology, with how you can be reborn in various realms and all of these kind of things. And if you really want to understand rebirth and karma fully, you have to take into account these other beings. Yeah, it's fascinating. One of the interesting things, sometimes you have people, they are very afraid of ghosts. Yeah. Is anyone here is afraid of ghosts? You don't have to raise your hand. Yes? Okay. Well, okay, you're being very honest. That's very good. People are often afraid of ghosts. Yeah. And so that's one of the jobs we have as monkeys, to do ghost busting. Yeah. We have a ghost in our house, a restaurant. Please come and get rid of this ghost. So we kind of try. We don't bust the ghost. We kind of friendly. We say, okay, ghost, please move on. Yeah. Okay. Enough of staying here. Move on to your next destination or whatever. So this is how we do ghost busting in a very kind of compassionate and kind way, because ghosts too want kindness. Yeah. Everyone wants kindness, including ghosts. So the people say, oh, I'm really afraid of ghosts. But that's actually the wrong way to think about ghosts. If you have the possibility to ever see a ghost or see a divine being or seeing anything which is unusual, you should say, yay, come to me, I want to see you. Yeah, this is what you should really be saying. And the reason you should be saying that is because that gives you an insight. It gives you a glimpse into a larger reality, a reality that for the vast majority of people is completely cut off. And you think, wow, now it's much easy to believe something if you see it for yourself, right? So you should see that as a tremendous gift if you ever have the ability to see these kind of unusual supernormal beings. Because when you see a supernormal being, it opens up a possibility. It opens up a reality, a larger window on the world than you otherwise had. So you just say, thank you, ghost. Thank you so much for coming to see me. Now I will make some good merit on your behalf so you can be reborn in a good destination. Then you're doing it in the right way. If the ghost comes to you, it's because it wants something from you. It wants happiness. It wants you to do something kind towards it. So this is the first lesson to draw from this. Yeah, these things are important. They matter. They are not something that's to be thrown out with the kind of the cultural baggage of the past that doesn't matter anymore. No, these are core Buddhist ideas. Second thing which is interesting, and this is sometimes the Buddha talks in the suttas about using the devas as a contemplation. Yeah, and I mentioned in the beginning, I talked about how the devas are these beautiful beings, radiant beings. Yeah, their inner qualities shine out through their body. What you see when you see a radiant being is really you're seeing a radiant mind, a mind that is beautiful because of the good qualities that have been built up. And sometimes you can think to yourself, I'm living well. I'm doing the same thing that those beings did to become devas. I'm on the path to become a deva myself. I will radiate all this light and stuff because I have those good qualities inside of me. I'm heading in the right way. I'm keeping the five precepts. I'm listening to Dhamma talks. I'm doing meditation practice. Okay, sometimes I go to the monastery. Yeah. Wow, it's pretty good actually. Don't be down on yourself, yeah? Encourage yourself. It's good that you're doing these things. And then you know that you're heading in the right way. And that can give you a kind of joy. You know you're heading towards something positive. Yeah, okay, it is not the end of the game to become a deva, but it's a good consolation prize, yeah? If you don't make it all the way, deva, okay, I'll take the consolation prize of becoming a deva. Sometimes we have to accept the consolation prizes in life. But the final point of all of this, yeah, the thing that really is the most important and the most interesting thing about these devas is that when you start to read about them in the suttas, and I did an online retreat recently, which was what we can learn from the devas, and what you start to see about the devas is that they are really very much like human beings. Yeah, they are glorified human beings. They are human beings with more happiness, more power, but they're just like us, really. Yeah, they have their suffering in life. They have they have love songs. They're trying to kind of, trying to get this girl to get attention from this girl. Oh, what can I do to get attention of this girl? It's this kind of things that in the human realm is a problem all the time. Yeah, or if you're a girl, you want to have attention from the guy or whatever it is. Yeah, or they have wars in the heavenly realm. If you look at some of the ancient mythology, there's always wars in the heavenly realm between the gods. Same thing in the ancient Hindu or Vedic religion. Yeah. So, and they have to finally, worst of all, they have to die. Even though they have very long lives compared to humans, ultimately they have to die. Where are they going to go when they die? They don't know. When the Buddha comes around and says, you guys, yeah, I don't know if he says you guys to the devas, but you devas, yeah. Your life is limited. Yeah, you may be powerful and beautiful, all of that, but you too will have to die. Your realm is impermanent. And then the devas think, oh, I thought we were permanent. We will last forever. It seems that we have to die. And then they fall into fear and despair because death is for everyone in this world, whether you are deva or human. Death is kind of a bit scary, right? What's going to happen when I die? Don't know. I have to give up everything and I move towards something unknown. That combination of giving up everything and moving towards the unknown is kind of, it's a bit scary, right? That's why people are afraid of death. Devas have the same problem. And when you start to see this, yes, okay, I'm willing to take the consolation prize if I have to. But really you start to understand that this whole world, yeah, whether it's devas or ghosts or humans or whatever it is, it is all has the same underlying problem of impermanence, of things being out of control, things not really working. Yeah, so we should not really aim for the heavenly realms either. It's quite common in the Buddhist world to aim for being reborn in the heavenly realm, but actually not really good enough. Because that too is problematic in the long run. There too you will suffer. There's only one real goal on the Buddhist path, and that is the goal of awakening itself. Yeah, that is what we should all be aiming for in Buddhism, because only then do we go beyond all of these realms, all of these problems, all the suffering and all the happiness in the world, and you go beyond all of that, then you are safe from the problems of existence. And that is the kind of final and most important lesson to be learned from the devas. Okay, there you are. Okay, everyone, so any questions, comments, complaints? Well, we have to give the president first of all. So, Mr. President Hock Chin, thank you.
Yeah. Ajahn, can you please explain about like what you have just said about impermanent and the COVID is what is happening now? It's like really frightening the world.
Mm. Yeah, that's a very good point. It's something I have talked about here before, because it is a very important point, and this is the COVID. A lot of people are really concerned about that and really worried about it. But really, that what we should remember is that this is what the world is like. Yeah, COVID comes, COVID goes. Of course, it will go again. And when it's gone, we become heedless just like before. And then when the next COVID comes, oh no, we didn't know COVID was coming. Actually, you had a COVID before. What do you mean you don't know it's coming? Just like we had pandemics before already, yeah, back in the early 19th century or whatever, or 20th century. So this is actually the main lesson to me from COVID, is to remember that the world is inherently problematic. Yeah, climate change. Okay, climate change is looking like a really bad thing at the moment. Yeah, happening everywhere. We see the floods happening in Europe, the fires we had in Australia and now in the United States. And all of these things are obviously boosted by higher temperatures. Yeah, and so what to do? Well, what to do is... we do our best to avoid these things if we can, but also realize that this is the nature of our world. The world is like this. Sometimes we cannot stop these things. The forces are greater than our ability to deal with them. And so that is, so what that does when we see that this is the nature of the world is that actually we turn a little bit away from that world and instead we turn towards the spiritual path. If the external world is out of control, we instead turn to the internal world instead, because the internal world is something we can do something about. We can choose to be kind. We can choose to do some meditation practice. We can choose to be generous and all these kind of things. So we understand that actually where to find the refuge is within, not without. That, I think, is the final and the most important lesson to be drawn from the whole COVID pandemic and all of that. Yes, please.
Thank you for a very fascinating talk. Got a lot out of it. I wanted to see if you could clarify. I think you touched on it from a Dharma perspective, why it's impossible for there to be the Creator God. Is it, I'm going to make an attempt here, is it because of emptiness, the emptiness of separate form and impermanence? Is that why, from a Dharma perspective?
Yeah, that is kind of the higher understanding. Yeah, what the argument I made during the talk was simply that you can never know a creator God or a permanent God. It's something that cannot be known directly because you cannot know permanence or creation as such. But from a deeper point of view, what you're saying is right, because what you can do is you can have insight into the nature of reality as such, and that is seeing that everything is impermanent. Yeah, if you see your body and mind as impermanent, then you are, by implication, all bodies and minds are impermanent in the same way. Huh? And you know that there is no such thing as permanence in the whole world, actually. Huh? So from a deeper insight point of view, that is right, yeah.
So that kind of debunks the whole eternalist perspective.
It does, yeah. So, but you only really see that when you have a very deep insight into the nature of reality. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, Prem.
In a Dhamma perspective, Ajahn, can these multiple gods that they are, Can they help or harm humans, or why do some ask for help?
Can the devas, help or harm humans?
Yeah.
Potentially, yes. Potentially, they can. They can more likely to help you than harm you, because they, you know, they are beings with kind of very good qualities. But they can also harm you, because some of them are bad gods. Yeah. So it's possible in theory. But in practice, they are so preoccupied with enjoying themselves in the heavenly realm, they don't take much interest in the human beings. We're kind of the lower beings, yeah. We're kind of like a bit like we look at animals. They probably look at us a bit like animals, and dirty, smelly, kind of. I can imagine. But in theory, yes. But I think one of the problems in the Buddhist world is that we sometimes rely on gods. Yeah, you find many Buddhists also who were kind of. Put out some offering for gods, yeah, and I think that is where we go too far. Yeah, sometimes if you are a good person and you have good qualities, the gods will look after you regardless, because they are pleased with you and they know that, you know, you are worthy of being looked after. And sometimes you hear stories about that, people who reckon they have things like guardian angels looking after them. And that could be a bit like the devas looking after you. So that is really the right way, but we should never rely on that. It is not something that we should seek out. If it happens as a matter of, if it just happens because it happens, then let it happen. But we should not seek being guarded by the devas in the world, because then we are really straying away from what the Dhamma is all about. And we're looking for certainty where there is no certainty anymore. The devas are not really that interested in us. Maybe they will look after us, maybe they won't. Whether we put out a bit of food for them or not, it's not going to make that much difference. They're not all that keen on human food anyway, yeah? But be good, live well. Then there's some chance they will look after you. Huh?
Thank you, Ajahn.
Okay. So let's have a look at some of the questions from outside of Dhammaloka Center. First is from John from Penang. Hello, John. May I know why certain individuals are born with the ability to see and communicate with spirits and devas? Is this a blessing or due to bad karma? Well, it's, you know, the way to see and communicate with spirits and divine beings is to have a very peaceful mind. It's the mind of samadhi. When the mind really comes together, that is the sort of mind that can communicate with or see things that we cannot see in the ordinary world. And the reason is because when you withdraw into your mind, you connect with that mental world, the mental world, the larger mental world, yeah? Not just your private mental world, but also the mental world beyond. I think the world is far more mental than we sometimes realize. And I don't mean mental in the sense of crazy, but you know. So if you have done meditation in a past life, you are born into this life with a fairly peaceful mind, maybe you have abilities in meditation because of what you have done in the past, then there is a chance you will be able to see those devas and beings as a consequence of that. So it really depends on that past, how you have lived in the past. Is it karma? It's kind of karma, yeah, but it's really about the development of the mind. That is the most important thing here. Okay, then there's a question from Nick from Olamara. Nick, okay. I certainly know one Nick in Olamara, but anyway, so I'm not sure if it is the Nick I know, but some Nick anyway. So hello, Nick. Is there an etymological link between deva and devil? It's a good question. Is there a link there? And I think quite possibly there is. Yeah, because the devil is like a fallen angel. The devil is like a, you know, super, is it like a being which is kind of made in human imagination to some extent, but which also could very well be linked to the idea of deva. So that's an interesting point. I'm not 100% sure, but when you look at the two words, deva and devil, it seems quite plausible that there is a link there. So, good point. Question from Eddie from Indonesia. Dear Ajahn, when we feel like the world is full of suffering, we aren't interested in it. How do we find passion to live when we're not even interested in life with people in general? What you do is you become a monk. Yeah? Bliss kind of monk. Check out the world, tick, and you take on the Dhamma instead. Is that right, Vasagha? Why not? Yeah, so Vasagha agrees. Yeah, he's a little bit reluctant, but I think he agrees. So there's two against one. No, no. not being naughty. So you remember that, you know, the world, there is a lot of suffering in the world. Don't allow it to depress you. Instead of being depressed and feeling bad about it, understand that there is a way out. There is an alternative. That way out is called the Dhamma. Yeah, there's the inner life that we can deal, that we can do things with. Sometimes when you see people die in the world in terrible disasters and terrible wars and whatever is going on, it isn't necessarily as bad as it may seem. Because when someone dies, yeah, even if they die in a really difficult and bad situation, it's the quality of heart which decides where they go afterwards. Yeah, so sometimes you see people in war zones being very kind and caring because they look after other people. Compassion arises when the world is going, sometimes anyway, it arises when the world is going in the wrong direction. People look after each other, and when they do that in a difficult zone, they can expect a good rebirth because they're building up all the kindness inside. So sometimes when you see those terrible pictures on TV, people dying, it is not necessarily as bad as it may seem. Many of those people may actually end up being reborn in a good place. Then it isn't so bad anymore, right? Oh yeah, maybe your family member, yeah, I'm actually up here in heaven right now, so you know, don't cry too much about me. Yeah, I'm good. Just chillax, you know, and carry on with your life. That's sometimes how I think about my dad. My father died a couple of years ago. I thought, well, he's probably, you know, now having a good time in some nice place, yeah, so I don't really need to worry too much about him. Are you there, Dad? Can you hear me? I don't know. Would be cool if you could. Don't make a sign. That's too scary. Don't make a sign. So let's leave that for now. Okay, last question. Another one from Indonesia. Is it correct to say that the difference between humans and devas is the amount of good karma, or is it about the quality of mind, or both? Well, good karma and quality of mind is the same thing. Yeah, good karma means building up good qualities in your mind. If you are generous and you live with kindness, you tend to feel good about yourself. You think back about the good things you have done and feel, yeah, I'm living a good life. I can feel good about myself. So don't be afraid of feeling good about yourself. Don't boost your ego. Don't think that, yeah, I'm the best, you know. Don't kind of become silly about it. But you're allowed to have that warm inner feeling about yourself where you feel good about yourself. That is recommended in Buddhism because that is a spiritual positive feeling that will lead you forward on the path. So good karma and developing the mind are two sides of the same coin. Good karma doesn't mean that you get a big house in your next life. The most important thing of good karma, you might do, but it is much more than that. It is really about how you feel about yourself in the present. That is what it's really about. Okay, everyone, that is all for tonight. So I wish you all a marvelous night. Have a good night's rest. And let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha before we go here.